Committee will come to order. Please take your seats. We don't have a quorum yet, so we'll not read the minute or approve the minutes until we get a quorum. Today, we are having some testimony by Legacy Fund recipients making their presentations. And starting out, if we follow the order on the agenda with the PCA and Rebecca Flood. So, Ms. Flood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rebecca Flood. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy at the Pollution Control Agency. I'm pleased to present here to you today, and what we would like to do is to provide you with a brief overview, starting with some federal and state clean water legislation that affects clean water programs here in the state of Minnesota as we administer them, and then we would like to have each one of the agencies who have received clean water funds, state agencies, make up just a very brief presentation to you, and I've discussed that with your committee administrator. So let me start off with the foundation for our clean water work, which is the Federal Clean Water Act of 1972. The goal of the 72 Clean Water Act is to restore, maintain, the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. This includes the very ambitious goal of making all waters fishable and swimmable by 1983. So although we've not yet met that goal, progress has been made, and obviously there's still a lot to be done. In addition, the Act establishes a regulatory framework to restore water quality, which has been primarily focused on controlling point sources of pollution, discharges from wastewater treatment plants and factories, primarily through a permitting, compliance, and enforcement regulatory framework. Agricultural non-point sources of pollution are specifically exempted from this regulatory approach. The Act also requires that water quality standards be developed to protect aquatic life, recreation, and water consumption. The MPCA is required to monitor and assess our waters, and where those waters fail to meet standards, where they are impaired, we are required under federal law to develop what is called a total maximum daily load, or TMDL, type of plan that specifies how much pollution has to be reduced in order to bring the water body back to meet water quality standards, so essentially putting that water body on a pollution diet. Then various implementation activities occur so that the water bodies can then be brought back to standards. Failure to comply with the requirements of the Clean Water Act could have long-lasting effects on human health, the environment, and our economic well-being. There have been instances in the past where a new or expanded facility had planned to discharge to an impaired water, but was prohibited from doing so until that TMDL or pollution diet was in place. This effectively stopped economic development where that new or expanded discharge needed to occur. So let's fast forward from 1972 to more recent activities in the state of Minnesota. As some of you may know, in 2006, the Clean Water Legacy Act was passed by the Minnesota Legislature. The Act focused efforts to monitor and assess the conditions of our waters and on restoring impaired waters, those waters that don't meet those water quality standards, and provided one-time funding to kickstart that effort. It required that the state develop an approach to monitor and assess the waters of the state within 10 years. We have developed and piloted and are now operating under this 10-year watershed approach. In addition, the law also created the Clean Water Council. This 2006 law is still in force and effect. And then, of course, as you know, and the purpose of this committee, in 2008, the citizens of the state passed a constitutional amendment called the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment. In addition to setting up the Outdoor Heritage Fund, it set up a Clean Water Fund, and the amendment expanded the clean water responsibilities of the Legacy Act beyond just restoring those impaired waters, but it also included protection and enhancement of our unimpaired waters, as well as dedicating at least 5% of the Clean Water Fund sales tax receipts to drinking water protection. One of the primary differences between the Clean Water Fund and the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Fund is that legislation authorized work under Clean Water several years before the amendment passed, in addition to our storied history going back to 1972 with the passage of the Clean Water Act. Clean water is a priority for Minnesota, and protecting our waters is a joint effort of the Pollution Control Agency and six partner agencies, including the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority, and the Metropolitan Council. The partners have developed a coordinated, efficient approach for protecting and restoring the state's waters, and funds have been allocated among these agencies to support many different types of activities and projects. As you can see from this chart, over $152 million in clean water funds have been allocated for water quality monitoring and assessment at 14% of the total, water quality studies and the development of those TMDL restoration plans and also protection strategies, again 14% of the total, drinking water protection at 9% of the total, and water quality protection and restoration activities, $96.5 million or 63% of the total. So you can see that the lion's share of these clean water funds are going to the Public Facilities Authority to improve wastewater treatment plants and to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for on-the-ground protection and restoration projects. Now turning towards specific agencies' appropriations and outcomes, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency was appropriated approximately $47 million for four major program areas. In monitoring and assessment, which we received $16.74 million, this funds our intensive monitoring of the 10-year monitoring and assessment watershed approach cycle. This system and approach provides systematic method to identify impaired and unimpaired waters, good coverage of stream and lake sites within each major watershed, and opportunities to coordinate with other agencies, local units of government, and volunteers. Our results through 2010, we will have cumulatively monitored more than 1,100 stream sites, or 25% of the streams in the state, 68% of the lakes greater than 500 acres, and 35% of the lakes 100 to 500 acres in size. By the end of fiscal 11, 35 of the 81 major watersheds within the state will have been assessed, 43% of them then. And by the end of this upcoming biennium, fiscal 12 and 13, intensive monitoring will be completed on 62% of watersheds. In addition, we're on track to intensively monitor all 81 major watersheds within the state by the end of 2017. Regarding TMDL and protection plan development, we were appropriated $19.1 million. We study sources of impairments and develop those TMDL or restoration plans, and also develop protection strategies for waters that are not impaired. Regarding our results, more than 70% of impairments identified so far have TMDLs either completed or underway. 15% of the state's watersheds have projects in progress, and we anticipate 43% will by 2013. Regarding our appropriation for protection and restoration, a little over $9 million, these dollars go primarily to deal with legacy contamination issues on the St. Louis River. Regarding our appropriation of $2.25 million for drinking water protection, that goes to enhancement of ambient groundwater monitoring network, emerging contaminants groundwater monitoring, and groundwater surface water modeling, where we have five surface groundwater models being completed by the end of these fiscal 2011. So for our results, we have monitored 46 wells for contaminants of emerging concern in cooperation with the U.S. Geological Survey. We've installed 17 additional monitoring wells in 2010 for the ambient groundwater monitoring network. where we also anticipate installing another 15 wells and have acquired 10 monitoring wells from the Department of Natural Resources or others. Contracts have been executed to obtain landowner access to install the remaining ambient network monitoring wells, and contractors have identified 18 additional monitoring well sites as of this January. Now, regarding the other agencies who've received appropriations from the Clean Water Fund, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which will be presenting later on in this committee, was appropriated $39.3 million, and they will be elaborating on this appropriation and their outcomes when they testify next. And regarding the DNR, as I understand it, they are on the agenda for next Wednesday, and they will be reviewing their appropriation of $18.5 million from the Clean Water Fund at that time. And next, I would like to introduce Terry Kuhlman with the Public Facilities Authority to discuss that agency's appropriation.
Well, for the record, my name is Terry Kuhlman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority, which is a multi-agency authority. I have six different state agencies that govern the work of the PFA. We were provided $32.7 million. Most of that was TMDL grant program. Last fiscal year, we funded 14 projects for $9.3 million. This year, we have 23 applications for over $24.9 million. They have until the end of the fiscal year to actually bid their project. And we do fund based on PCA's project priority list so that the balance of the funds there are reserved for projects. We've made a couple awards this year already, but they do have until the end of June to actually bid their projects, and then we'll issue the grant contract. The phosphorus reduction grant program, we got $8.5 million. And last fiscal year, we did 8 projects for $3.2 million. We've got 10 applications for $3.5 million. We still have a balance there, or should have by the end of the year, in that program. The small community wastewater treatment program was really designed to keep really small communities, often unincorporated, out of the municipal wastewater system, that is collection and treatment plant, and designed to do replacement of septics for homeowners that volunteer to do that. Or small cluster mound systems, kind of low-tech, low-cost alternatives to municipal wastewater systems. The program is designed because these communities are very small, often do not have the financial nor the technical capability to do a lot, to provide grants to do the technical assistance so they can hire an ISTS person to actually design the system, do the soil borings to make sure, determine what type of septic system would be available, and then get that community ready to actually go ahead and proceed with the project. So it's really a two-phase approach in this program. The first is we provide technical assistance grants up to $500 per household and a $10,000 lump sum grant for the design and planning of the system. And then the second phase, once they know what the solutions are, we provide loan and grant combinations, 50% loan, 50% grant for the projects. And so far we've have 17 technical assistance grants out there this year. Last year we did 5. We had a total of 14 active going on last year, and now we've got about 21 either being concluded or in process. And we've awarded only a couple, 2 projects last year and 1 so far this year for actual construction. So it's kind of gearing up and moving towards it. The problem we're running into with that program is a lot of these small communities, the option that we thought was to replace septics is not necessarily viable because of the real small lots and the soil conditions. So we're kind of going with cluster systems, which requires kind of a collection system, so the cost adds has been growing on a lot of these small projects. So that's something we're going to be addressing in the future, how to deal, best deal with those very small communities. With that, quick summary.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Anyone have any questions of Mr. Coleman?
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank
you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Bozicki. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'd like to describe the nearly $9 million of funds that have been allocated to the Department of Agriculture. First of all, as a general background for the committee members, the dollars that are being used by the Department of Agriculture are being put into several areas. Some of those are on-the-ground practices. Some of those dollars are being used to help growers conduct assessments of their practices and to help them with technical solutions. Some of the dollars are being used to better understand and describe the water quality issues associated with various best management practices. And some of the dollars are being used to help us understand our water quality through monitoring. And finally, some of the dollars are being used to demonstrate and to test best management practices. Clearly, agriculture is going to be part of the solution. And what we found is folks in agriculture are committed to being a part of that, those solutions. One of the projects that we have that we're involved with is a pesticide monitoring project. This was an appropriation of $675,000 to the department to increase laboratory capacity. We have purchased a GC, LC-MS. This particular piece of equipment is going to increase our capacity to sample, to run samples, and to look at lower levels, lower concentrations, and more products and pesticide products and breakdown products than we ever have before. For example, we will be increasing about our analysis on to about an additional 600 water quality samples. We will be looking at levels instead of parts per billion, at parts per trillion. And for each sample, instead of looking at 44 analysis, we'll be looking at 100 different analytes. One of the other projects that we have undergoing is a ground and drinking water protection. This is the $1.12 million that's shown on the slide. It's a variety of projects that are taking place here. We are working with a number of local cooperators to increase our monitoring. For example, we're looking at a project in Central Sands where we will be working with 13 different counties and conducting nitrate analysis on about 2,300 private wells. Out of that, eventually, we hope to develop a long-term nitrate monitoring project. We are working with local units, local communities, and source water protection areas. We're conducting surveys to better understand exactly what kind of nitrogen and fertilizer management practices growers are implementing so we can target pest management practices. And we're working with local units of government, SWCDs, to improve irrigation practices, and to better understand the relationship of farming practices that are actually taking place in local areas and the effects on groundwater contamination by nitrates. One of the important components that we're taking a look at is research. This is under the protection and restoration. We have recently completed a round of RFPs for $1.25 million. These projects the contracts have not been issued, so we can't talk about the specific projects that are underway. But suffice it to say that the focus of the research is going to develop develop more accurate information about the egg contribution and its relationship to water quality impairments. The idea is to not only understand them, but then to also develop best management practices and hopefully resolve some of those issues in an economic and an environmentally sound fashion. Finally, what I'll point out is that we have $4.5 million of the allocation were used for our ag best management loan program. This program's been operating since 1995. Approximately $3.1 million have been already allocated to local units of government, and the remainder will be allocated this March. This is used to put practices on the ground, such as purchase of tillage equipment through low-interest loans, erosion control, ag waste management, and septic system management practices. Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Buzicki. One question. How much of this would you have been able to do without legacy funding?
Mr. Chair, very little. I mean, this is all in addition to the practices that we have been putting on the ground and the research that we have been doing. So certainly we have had, for instance, the Ag BMP loan program, but the $4.5 million is really focused on practices that really that augment and build up the program. So it's additional resources. So very little, if anything, could we have accomplished this without these funds. It's, Mr. Chair, I might add, in my tenure, this is perhaps one of the most exciting times we've had. We actually have resources now to go out and work with growers and work with folks to better understand what's taking place to resolve these issues.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Buzicki. Anyone, any members have any? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Szczepanski, could you clarify a little more for me that about the loan program? And you said it started in 1995, but it's the most exciting time, and this new money augmented. How is the new money not doing what the old money did?
Mr. Buzicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the old money has certainly focused on a variety of practices to improve best management practices and to get resources out to help growers. My understanding is that these dollars are targeted for the water quality issues, certainly, and it provides an additional resources for local units of government and entities to get the loan dollars out there. Specifically, I guess I'd have to go to our experts and get you some information. We'd be happy to do that. But my understanding is this is above and beyond what we've been able to do in the past.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Szczepanski, and what happens to this program in the next go-round?
Mr. Buzicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the governor at this point has not provided the budget recommendations. Those decisions still have to be decided. Final decisions have to be made. So the amount of dollars, I think if you're asking the amount of dollars that are going to be committed,
what are you requesting? What is your plan for the future? Are you going to continue with the $4 million, or are you going to, is this going to be complete?
Mr. Chair, I believe the intention is to ask for additional dollars to continue to get more loans out, but I don't have those specifics. Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe there will be a request to ask for additional dollars to continue to broaden the program to get more practices on the ground.
One final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Szczepanski, when you provide additional information to us to clarify, could you also tell us what the outcomes you are expecting to receive?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Mr. Buzicki, you will convey the information to us that is being requested, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buzicki, Maybe this is another way of getting at the question that Representative Murphy asked. Of the best management practices that we are funding with this water money, how many of them have been tested to see that they actually have water benefits? Is that helping, Representative Murphy? Not the same thing. Well, but that's my question.
Mr. Bozicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, there's a number of practices that are eligible historically under this program. I use, for example, tillage equipment. The purchase of tillage equipment, minimum tillage equipment, is an eligible best management practice. So that is an accepted practice, if you will. I am also aware, for example, that septic system improvements and modifications are eligible. It goes through a process, and we'd be happy to provide those practices which are eligible for this loan money.
Mr. Chair, could I follow up?
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, I think some additional information would be helpful, but I think you're answering a question I didn't ask. I'm specifically asking, of the best management practices that we're funding, on-the-ground practices, how many of those practices have actually been tested for water quality outcomes? And do you have a ranking of those, or at least a testing of those to see that they do have very specific water quality outcomes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I don't have that information. I'd be happy to relay that specific request and bring an answer to that question back to the committee.
Super. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Bozicki.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. My name is John Stein. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And about 75% of all Minnesotans drink their water from groundwater sources. 25% drink water from surface water sources, either the Mississippi River, lakes, or other rivers in the state. The Minnesota Department of Health is responsible for the Safe Drinking Water Act implementation in the state of Minnesota. So the Minnesota Department of Health is to drinking water as the Pollution Control Agency is to wastewater, if you will. The federal act that authorizes the Pollution Control Agency is the Clean Water Act. We operate under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And the legislation that appropriated clean water funding to the Department of Health was for two purposes, and this slide describes it. It's $3.75 million over the biennium for accelerated source water protection activities. And source water protection activities are to enhance the source protection, exactly as the words say, that we do not want water supplies contaminated, and we want to eliminate potential sources of contamination so that drinking water sources are protected. The other funding that the agency received was for characterization of unregulated drinking water contaminants. Under these two activities, we had goals, which we have been working to achieve. Under our source water protection activities, we were to assist 30 communities in fiscal year 10 in accelerating the development of their source water protection plans. And we have fulfilled that. We've assisted 32 communities in fiscal year 10. In fiscal year 11, our charge is to assist 60 communities with accelerating their source water protection activities, and we're on track with that. So far, we've assisted 66 communities in fiscal year 10. That's in addition to the work that we already do under funding we receive from the Environmental Protection Agency for the Safe Drinking Water Act and our own and other sources of money. One of the things we aim to do with this accelerated funding for source water protection is complete the development of source water protection plans by the year 2020. There are 950 community drinking water systems in the state. There have been about 420 of those systems have completed or are in process of completing their source water protection plans at the present time. So with accelerated funding, the department intends to continue the accelerated plans to complete those source water protection activities. Under the unregulated or contaminants of emerging concern efforts, we were to develop three unregulated contaminants in fiscal year 2010. We did that. We looked at contaminants that could serve as endocrine disrupting compounds, potential carcinogens, and other compounds that might have adverse consequences on human health and the nervous system. Our goal for 2011 is to complete the characterization of 7 contaminants, and we are on track to do that. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. Representative Wagenius, just quickly first. We're getting a lot of information from various testifiers. We would like this PowerPoint emailed to us, or hard copy, whatever is better. But some of the information that you are giving is not on the PowerPoint. Are we going to get a written report on this as well?
Mr. Chair, we can certainly provide. I understand the PowerPoint's available electronically, so we'll be forwarding that to committee staff. And secondly, the details that we've each been covering as agencies, I take it that you'd like us to provide that information. We'll do that.
I think that'd be helpful to the committee. Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'm glad to see you're working on protection of wells that we're already using. And we're kind of going back and fixing something for going forward for wells that people are digging this year. Do you require that they have a source water protection plan in place before they go ahead and dig that well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I'm not sure. I'm looking at my staff people. Do we, Randy? Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the answer was no, we do not require that they have a plan in place prior at the time of construction of a new well.
Representative Wagenius?
Well, that feels very expensive, so we're not necessarily choosing the best place because it looks like somebody might come in and backfill a bad choice. So it seems to me that in order to make good choices and for somebody else not to come in and subsidize, we need to make sure that for each new well there is a source water protection plan in place. I mean, that only makes common sense. I don't think people who voted for this money, they wanted the money to clean up, but they didn't mean it as a subsidy for activities in the future where people should be taking care of their own wells. And I say that because I know that there's not enough money to do that, and that's not fair to the people who voted for this. So that's my opinion of this, but I suspect that's what voters would think. Would you?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius,
Mr. Klein.
I understand the context that in our drinking water protection program, we do work with the communities when they're siting new wells. And so there is planning that goes with that. I understand your point, which is you don't want to create a problem that later must be funded by others than those responsible for the mistake in the first place. I understand completely. What we'll do is we'll look at that issue and try to address how does our planning efforts and our programmatic decisions impact on that. If we have a means of accomplishing that without changing anything that we're currently doing, I'll come back to you and we'll talk about that.
What, Mr. Chair?
Representative Wagenius?
I suspect you may have to change some things you're already doing, but the question reoccurs. When people voted for this money, I think they expected that we were going to use it to clean up past problems and to do some prevention. But I don't think they would be happy to learn that we're just funding ongoing activities that should be funded by those people. If somebody's building a well, they should fund their own source water protection plan. I don't think people would be happy to hear that's how their money's being spent. They want to clean up other things because there's so much work to be done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Point taken, Representative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Klein. Before you start in, we do have a quorum here, and Representative Dill moves to approve the very fine minutes of January 11th. Is there a second? There's a second by Representative Pepin. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Chris Alvram. I'm the Water Supply Planning Manager at the Metropolitan Council.
Name again, please.
Sorry, Chris Alvram.
Thank you. Continue, please.
Just to give you a very brief background, for the past several years, the Met Council has been undertaking a regional water supply planning effort that has resulted in the development of a master water supply plan for the 7-county metro area. That plan identifies issues that communities will have to face in the development of their water supply plans, things like impacting surface water features from future withdrawals, or areas where we know there's contamination and they'll have to deal with that as they develop their water supply system. The plan also outlines tools and resources for those communities to address those issues. It also identifies ongoing information and analysis needed to improve our decision making for future supplies. So the funds that were received from the Clean Water Fund are being used to address those issues, as well as collect information and conduct the analysis identified in the Master Water Supply Plan. We are in the process of undertaking three local water resource planning efforts. One, for example, in southern Washington County, where a trout stream, it relies on groundwater to support its aquatic system, and the cities of Woodbury and Cottage Grove are growing and use that same groundwater. There's also PFCs in the groundwater, as many of you already know. And we, through our planning effort, have identified that area as potential for significant drawdown due to that future growth. So we're working with those communities, the state agencies, the county watershed districts, to develop a plan so that the communities can meet their projected demands and their future needs, as well as protect those resources and avoid that contamination. We are also developing tools and resources for communities to make decisions, things like a water conservation tool that will allow communities to promote water conservation, yet still gather the revenue needed to continue to operate and maintain and develop their water supply system. A second tool is being developed that will allow communities to evaluate and implement stormwater reuse projects so that they can balance or take away some of the water or drinking water that's used to irrigate ball fields, for instance. And finally, we are working closely with the Minnesota Geological Survey to conduct some regional mapping efforts to identify where glacial aquifers exist, what the recharge to those aquifers are, as well as the vulnerability to the aquifers across the region. We are also working close with the Department of Health and PCA in mapping known groundwater contaminant plumes. So this information will be used to provide the resources for communities, as well as the regulatory agencies, to ensure that future generations continue to have the water available and that we continue to protect those resources that we find valuable in the region. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alvin. Any questions, comments from any of the members? Okay, thank you.
In summary then, Mr. Chair, first of all, thank you on behalf of all of the state agencies for the opportunity to give you this brief overview today. As you know, we're in the process of completing the first biennium of the 25-year amendment, and we're making progress toward the long-term goal of protecting and restoring Minnesota's waters, and there still is a lot to be done. The partner agencies have been working together to develop system-wide coordinated strategies to address water quality. This coordinated approach helps ensure that complementary actions support the broader strategies, that the appropriate agencies are working toward their strengths, that we are adequately identifying problems and then taking the steps to fix them, and that we are properly targeting both federal and state funding where it can do the greatest good. The agencies represented here today work together to ensure that those resources, our precious water resources of the state, are managed to protect Minnesota's environment and economic well-being. And if there's any other questions, we'd be happy to take them at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Flood. I've got just the some clarification I need from some of your earlier comments.
Yes, sir.
You were saying that of our streams, that the 25% of them had been evaluated. Is that correct?
So far, we have had 25% of our streams monitored and assessed. Yes, sir.
Do you know the percentage of impairments found in that 25%?
I do not have that information handy with me.
Yeah, I have the same question that I would have regarding the lakes, and let me back up there as well. Did you say that of our lakes, 100 to 500 acres, that 35% had been evaluated?
Yes, that is correct, Mr. Chair.
And over 500, was it 68%? Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you don't have the percent of impairments there either?
I would be happy to get that.
I would really be interested in that. I'd like to know, of those being assessed, what level of impairment they have.
I will get that information to you and the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other members, any other questions, comments for Ms. Flood? All right, then. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I believe next we have Board of Water and Soil Resources, Julie Blackburn and John Jashke. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl and committee members.
Say that again.
Chair Erdahl.
Thank you.
I'll try to say it a few more times before I'm done here today. I'm Julie Blackburn, Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. Rebecca Flood talked on a slide about the funds that were provided to us. We are the state agency, the small state agency that is the lever for the many, many units of government out there that are implementing on the groundwork as the primary effort for the Clean Water Fund, actually getting clean water. We were asked to talk about both Outdoor Heritage and the Clean Water Fund and what we've done with that. I'm not doing a presentation. I've provided each of you with some handouts. They're just coming around now. There's a handout specific for each one of you that talks a little bit about the stories of Clean Water Fund projects that are going on in your area. And if we don't have a story yet about your particular area, we looked to find a story that's close to your area, where you come from, where your constituents are, or maybe it's something you might be very interested in. So I gave two overall documents and then a couple of the different stories. As Rebecca Flood mentioned, we had $38 million in clean water funds that came to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Those funds are to get real stuff done out throughout the state to help preserve and protect water quality. I'm going to just go over this brochure a little bit. It is the one that's titled Board of Water and Soil Resources FY 2010 and 11 Clean Water Fund Summary. On the front page, you'll see that we had three major categories of funding that total close to $20 million. These are the projects that went through a competitive process in order to get funded. So we developed ranking criteria that included outcomes, the ability to get the work done, the prioritization and a plan. We ranked and reviewed each one of those along with our agency partners from DNR, Pollution Control Agency, Department of Health, and Department of Ag, and we selected the best of the best. Altogether, we have close to 140 competitive projects that have been implemented and approved. And when you open the inside, what we tried to do is give you a sample of the types of projects that are going in on the ground. This is we selected a variety of projects from throughout the state. For instance, just if I start at the very top of the page, Lake of the Woods, SWCD. This is a project that addresses water quality concerns that were addressed from previous monitoring efforts. It's very targeted. It is all about one specific bay trying to clean it up. Going around the chart just a little bit, Pelican River Watershed District on the left-hand side. They received funds in 2010, $250,000. That leveraged over $1.5 million from both the federal government and the state government in order to restore a wetland, which was the single discharge, single largest discharge of phosphorus to the Detroit Chain of Lakes, which we all know is a critical resource for that area. Just a couple of other examples on the left-hand side, Clearwater River Watershed District, Chair Erdahl, might be interesting for you. That is a trout stream restoration project that treats the stormwater from the city of Kimball, which discharges in a trout stream, which then we know goes into the Clearwater Chain of Lakes, which is a water body which is improving in the state. Right underneath that, the example of the Lincoln SWCD Wellhead Protection Program. This is a new one that we just approved in December, or the board just approved the funding for this. This is about nitrate management for farmers in the area of this wellhead protection plan. So it's a low-cost project, which we hope is going to save $6 million from needing to go into a nitrate removal plant that they need in that area if they don't contain some of that nitrate. So it's this kind of project that goes into helping protect and groundwater, drinking water, by doing conservation projects. There's a number of the different projects here. Some of them address TMDLs, the one that's on Bassett Creek. This one project, which prevents the backflow into some backwaters, is the one project that needs to get done that more than meets the TMDL reduction scenarios. Projects over in Cannon River Watershed Management Organization, they identify high priority erosion control sites that they're going to put extensions on CRP contracts so they can prevent those erosion sites from getting worse. On the Southeast Minnesota Technical Support, we provided funding for two nutrient management technicians to work on over 18 feedlot upgrades that are going in that address that TMDL. That's a huge area that they're working on down there, and this is a way to just really get a couple of people focused on that resource and that resource concern in a very small area. So again, this is just a sampling of the projects. We have a new way to learn about the projects that are getting funded. It's going to be available late this week or early next week. It's going to be on our website. We have you've been kind of waiting for the LCC website with all the Clean Water Fund projects to get launched, but it's taken a little too long, so we decided that we need to communicate what was happening in clean water on the ground activities ourselves. We are telling the story of each one of these competitive projects through a website, through the Bowser website. There will be a state map, and you'll be able to go over the state map and look at the little black dots that are color-coded dots that are on that map, and you'll get a little pop-up of the type of project that's gone on in that area, and you can click on it to get a PDF of the project partners, the project funding, the potential outcomes. Some of them were just funded in December, so they don't have outcomes yet, but we have planned outcomes so that everybody throughout the state, whoever they are, can learn anytime what's going on with these Clean Water Fund projects. So look for that late this week or early next week. So those are the competitive projects. I just want to go on the back side real quick to talk about some of the other things that we have through the Clean Water Fund. The Clean Water Fund provided money for conservation easements. Those are permanent easements. It's not outright purchasing the land. It's an easement that goes over private property. We had two different types of easements that were available under the Clean Water Fund. One of them is the riparian buffer. There was $6.9 million available for riparian buffers. We acquired 186 easements These were lands that had already been, had an investment, most of them, from the federal government through the CRP program. And what we did, since it was already established and it had already been identified as a high priority, we targeted these easement dollars towards those lands. So now they are permanently protected. We also had a new program, the Wellhead Protection Program, that we had $2.3 million available. And this was in those areas that are highly vulnerable in wellhead protection plans, targets those highly vulnerable areas. There's over 200 different locations throughout the state where these monies are available to put in those permanent conservation easements. On the very bottom of that page are a summary of the feedlots and the SSTS, the subsurface sewage treatment system programs that we put in place. We had $3.5 million available for counties to do enhancements and inventories on SSTS, both their own programs as well as doing the inventories. And we had $1.8 million available to address imminent health threats. So when they were out doing their inventories, if there was a septic system that was identified to have an imminent health threat, these funds were available. So we, through these funds, over 40 lakes have been inventoried, over five different river systems. 17 counties have upgraded their database or maybe made some of paper files more electronic now so that it can become systematic how they implement SSTS in their county. And 168 imminent health threats have been abated. We also had $4 million available for feedlot grants. These were available only for feedlots that presented a pollution problem within a riparian area. So they were very close to surface waters. We addressed 97 feedlots or are working on it, and that includes those two technicians that were funded with the Clean Water Technical Assistance Funds to get out there in the southeast Minnesota to address that TMDL, that impairment down there. So that's a summary of the Clean Water Fund portion of the legacy funds. I also wanted to talk about the Outdoor Heritage Funds a little bit, but I would take any questions you have on the Clean Water Fund.
Thank you, Ms. Blackburn. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blackburn, about the 186 easements, were those new easements for the conservation efforts?
Yep.
Ms. Blackburn.
Chair Erdahl and Representative Murphy, yes, these are new easements.
And are these easements from individuals?
Chair Erdahl and Representative Murphy, yes, they are from individuals. Our easement program is all about private lands. And so these were targeted just for mostly for the riparian areas. People that were mostly farmers that were already enrolled in the CRP program through the federal NRCS, FSA, excuse me. So they were already targeted because of their resource concern. They were already converted to buffer strips, and so we placed that permanent easement over the top of it. Our easement program isn't outright purchasing of the land, so it stays privately held and on the county tax rolls.
Ms. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, and then does the farmer property owner receive an annual stipend then for the easement?
Ms. Blackburn?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, no, not from us, not from the RIM program. If they are still enrolled in CRP, they will get their annual payment until their CRP contract expires. But now they have a permanent conservation easement, so the practice stays in place.
Representative Murphy?
Chair, Ms. Blackburn. Mm-hmm. So what was the money spent on then if the individuals didn't get money?
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, when we purchased the conservation easement, we do pay them for it. It's not an annual practice. It's a one-time payment, and it is to keep that in permanent protection. So it no longer goes back into cultivation or changes land use.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. So this one-time payment then, does everyone get the same amount, or is it based on per feet, or is it what? How is that determined?
Ms. Blackburn.
Chair Dahl and Representative Murphy, that's a good question. We actually work with the University of Minnesota Land Management Program in order to determine average tillable township value. And so it really is based on what's reported as far as township sales. They determine a per acre value for the township for tillable land, and that's what we use. And so it's updated every year based on those township values reported by counties to the University of Minnesota, who processes all of the statistics and reporting information, and that's what we use for the payment data. And I would be more than happy to provide you with the information about how we come to those numbers.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think, Ms. Blackburn, the main question that many of us are interested in is if this money is being used for programs that are beyond what you could have used with available money.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as far as anything additional, we've never had these programs before. For the rim buffer easement or the rim wellhead easement, they didn't exist. So these are all new. As far as the other funding, there was a couple of years that we had funding through the Clean Water Legacy Act. That was general fund. As far as our general funds that are available through the general fund to do practices and projects, we have about $4 million available through the biennium. So what we're talking about here is not just exponential, but, straight up, very, very increased amount of effort that's going on for clean water. So it's kind of incomparable almost. We wouldn't be able to do hardly any of this otherwise.
Hey, thank you. I'm glad that you're getting this onto your website. And there is a website that we're encouraging also that this be placed on, and that's www.legacy.leg.mn. Mm-hmm. So let's get it on that one too, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, we have submitted almost all of our projects over to the LCC to put them on. Ours is just going to be highlighting a little bit different, a little bit more detail about some of those projects.
Okay, thank you. Want to continue with the rest?
Continue with the Outdoor Heritage Funds. Those are the other portion of the legacy funds that we've received. There's a handout that's also looks kind of similar. This one is titled Reinvest in Minnesota Reserve Wetlands Leveraging Project. This is a project that is paid for partially through the Outdoor Heritage Funds. And what this is it's building on our RIM program. RIM program has been established since 1986. There's been about $170 million, mostly through bonding. The great majority of those funds have been through bonding that goes to restore critical wetland areas throughout the state. So this project works to leverage the Outdoor Heritage Funds with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, the federal partner, to leverage their wetland reserve project funds. On the inside, on the top left, you can see over fiscal year 2010 and fiscal year 2011, we've received about $16 million from Outdoor Heritage. That has leveraged $22 million from the federal government. These programs go back to back, dovetail together. Through those two funding programs, we've restored over 14,000 acres of wetlands and the associated uplands that go to protect that wetland. We also have a recommendation that's being forwarded from the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council for an additional $13 million this year, which we will leverage close to $21 million from the federal government if that project goes through. This project has a tremendous amount of benefits, and I think all of us are interested right now in making sure the economy of the state continues to grow. There are economic benefits from this project. Every time one of these wetlands goes in, it requires engineers, surveyors, people to go out there and run backhoes, to do leveling, to seed, to build. We know from the NRCS, every single year they reanalyze the economic activity that's generated from these projects, And from the type of funding that we're looking at here, from the $47.7 million that's been spent so far, we know 445 jobs have been created or maintained because of these programs. Additionally, we're getting the habitat, we're keeping the land in private ownership, and as we move through this program, we're working with NRCS to develop even more multiple benefits for the landowner. We're looking at ways that we can either do some kind of biofuel harvesting, some kind of flash grazing for invasive species management, different ways that the landowner continue to work and get benefit from that land while it's still in conservation easements. We work to build complexes throughout the state, and in the bottom left, you'll see that there is in Norman and Clay counties, we're working to build on top of or side by side with state management areas on private land, so we have larger complexes of ecological value. And on the left, or excuse me, on the right-hand side of the handout, you'll see that all the different places we've put wetlands and restored wetlands throughout the mostly the Forest Prairie Transition Zone, as well as the prairie section of the management sections that the Lessard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council makes their recommendations on. It is important to know we have all together about 6,400 different easements throughout the state. Over 220,000 acres are in permanent conservation from this program. Every single one of them, except for the ones we just got signed up, is available online. You can go to our website, you can query, you can see every single one of the conservation easements as well as the practices that are on every single easement. So we're doing our best to make sure that our programs are transparent and viewable by anybody in the state wherever you're at. On the back side is a couple of examples of some before and after, well, one example of a before and after in Jackson County. You'll see that several different wetland complexes were brought into the program, and it resulted in an over 110-acre site that was restored, both wetlands and the associated upland areas. You'll see some of those, again, those conservation easements, the benefits, the multiple benefits that we have. And again, these remain private landowners, which we think is an important part of the program delivery. That's what makes it so sellable and why we can get it done so quickly. Out of all of the funds that we've had available, the sign-ups have demonstrated over 2 to 3 times the amount of demand of the funding we've had available. So it's been a really successful project.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assume for a minute that the recommendations from the Lessard Sams for wetlands are done and we get the federal money. Is there federal money still sitting out there to be captured? If so, how much? And how much money would we have to put on the table?
Ms. Blackburn.
Chair Erdahl and Representative Wagenius, that's a good question. Every year when the NRCS makes their allocations to all of the states, states use what they can, and then they have to turn back what they haven't used within several months before the end of their fiscal year, which is in October. So usually around July, August, we start hearing that there's a lot more money available. We don't often know what it is, but we've been told that certainly it could double for us. So every year, instead of $25 million available, we would have $50 million available from the federal government. We also know that timing is kind of critical on this. The federal farm bill is probably going to be redone either 2012 or 2013. We would expect that there would probably be some decreases in the amount of federal funding available at that time. So it seems like there's kind of a narrow window here where we can really make the best use of these funds in order to get more wetlands done in this period of time. So the short answer is we would expect to double the amount of money that's available just in this year.
Representative Wagenius.
If you could just give us a number of what we would have to put on the table, it would be helpful to get the maximum or at least a range of federal funds. If it was between this and this, we'd get between that and that.
Right.
Ms. Blackburn.
Chair Erdahl and Representative Wagenius, I will get you more detailed numbers off the top of my head without working through the numbers and talking to NRCS right now. I would say it would be an additional $16 to $18 million just for an additional, not thinking about the outdoor heritage recommendations that are being put forward right now. But I want to double check all those numbers and make sure we get you the real number that works.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Ms. Blackburn.
Thank you.
Next, I believe we have the Metropolitan Council with Arnie Stefford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
I've got a PowerPoint presentation, which I will be loading into your computer here. You do have a handout of this presentation in your packet.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Arnie Stefford. I'm a planning analyst in the Parks Program at the Metro Council. I'm here today to give you an overview of the fiscal year 2010-2011 appropriation of Parks and Trails Legacy Fund dollars and how they were spent for the Metropolitan Regional Park System. As I said, the presentation is in your packet, and I will be following that as soon as we get it up online here.
I'd say, Mr. Stefford, we have two more presentations, and if we hold them to about 15 minutes each, we'll be all right.
Yeah, I should be able to do that, sir.
Thank you.
I'm going to be covering four topics today. I will start while this thing starts to buzz and whir. First thing is an overview of the Metropolitan Regional Park System. What is it? Secondly, a description of the fiscal year 2010 and 11 Parks and Trails Fund appropriation for the regional park system in the context of appropriations for state parks and other regionally significant parks and trails. Thirdly, a description of how the appropriation was distributed to Metropolitan Regional Park agencies. And fourth, a description of the projects which are funded from the appropriation. And all of that is included in your handout. I'll continue to go off of this, and once this thing gets lined up, we'll use it. On page 3 of your handout, the Metro Park System was established by legislation in 1974. It authorized the Metro Council to identify land which, together with state parks and trails, will meet the outdoor recreational needs of the people of the metro area. And it directed the Metro Council to grant capital funds to regional park agencies to acquire those identified lands and develop them in accordance with the Metro Council's Parks Policy Plan and with individual regional park and trail master plans. Since 1974, the Council has granted $353 million of state funds, including Parks and Trails Legacy Fund appropriations, state bonds, and Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund appropriations for land acquisition, park and trail facility development and rehabilitation, natural resource restoration projects, plus programs that benefit park and trail visitors. The Metro Council has provided $172 million from its own general obligation bonds to supplement the state's appropriations. And since 1985, the Council has disbursed $128 million of state funds to these park agencies to help partially finance the cost to operate and maintain the Metropolitan Regional Park System. So what is this system? It is owned and operated by 10 regional park agencies, which include the counties of Anoka, Ramsey, Washington, Dakota, Scott, Carver, and the cities of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, the cities of St. Paul, City of Bloomington, and Three Rivers Park District, which oversees regional parks in suburban Hennepin County. Some of these agencies also own and operate neighborhood parks, which are not part of the regional park system. The system, currently open for public use, encompasses 54,633 acres, and it hosts 38 million visitors a year. There are 39 regional parks, including Lake Waconia Regional Park, which is managed by Carver County. These parks range in size from 100 to 500 acres, and they provide opportunities for picnicking, swimming, trails, boating, and camping. There are 12 park reserves, which range in size from 1,000 to 5,000 acres. And in addition to those outdoor recreation activities I just described, they also include large areas of protected lands that represent landscape types that are found in the metro area. There are 12 landscape types that are protected, and that's why they are so large. And that's used for environmental education purposes. And one example is Rice Creek Chain of Lakes Park Reserve in Anoka County, which represents the Anoka County Sand Plain. There are 7 special recreation features, including Nuremberg Floral Gardens, which is managed by Three Rivers Park District. These special features have unique, one-of-a-kind outdoor recreation or environmental education facilities. Other examples include the Como Conservatory and the Como Zoo. And finally, there are 38 regional trails that link these parks together that encompass 231 miles to date. And one example is the Big Rivers Regional Trail that's managed by Dakota County. Moving on to the fiscal year 2010-2011 appropriation, there was $65 million appropriated in total for the biennium from the Parks and Trails Fund. The DNR State Parks and Trails System and the Metro Regional Park System each received $27.78 million. The DNR also received $8.87 million for a statewide grants program that financed solar energy, land acquisition, and capital projects for parks and trails of regional significance. These grants financed up to 75% of project costs, and the grant applicant provided the other 25%. Finally, $650,000 was appropriated to the University of Minnesota and the DNR for an inventory framework of state and regionally significant parks and trails, and to finance the creation of a 25-year Parks and Trails Legacy Plan, which will be presented to the legislature in mid-February. In regards to the council's $27.78 million, in the appropriation legislation, there was a formula under Minnesota Statute 85.53 that required 10% of that appropriation, or $2.77 million, to be devoted for parkland acquisition, which would partially finance those acquisition costs. And the other 90% was appropriated for non-acquisition projects or programs. The land acquisition component, this slide illustrates what's been spent to date of that $2.77 million. $1.96 million has been dispersed so far. In addition to that, there's been $445,000 of Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund money, plus $2.6 million of Metro Council bonds, and $1.66 million of park agency funds that have been used to buy properties under this program. 7 parcels with a total of 53 acres. The lands are shown, actually, where these parks or these parcels are shown in the context of the parks where they were acquired. We have them at Lake Waconia Park in Carver County, the Elm Creek Park Reserve in suburban Hennepin County, 2 parcels in Above the Falls Regional Park in Minneapolis, a parcel in Gray Cloud Island in Washington County, and 2 parcels at Bald Eagle Otter Lakes Regional Park in suburban Ramsey County. Regarding the other 90% of those funds, that $25 million figure, the law required that be dispersed to the regional park agencies using a formula which takes into account the population of that park agency's jurisdiction, total visits that park agency hosts for its regional parks and trails, its cost to operate and maintain its portion of the metro regional park system, the amount of visitors it receives from people living outside its jurisdiction, which we call non-local visits, and the amount of land that agency manages for the regional park system. And the weight, figures in the percentage in the parentheses is the weight given to the formula. So 35% of that $25 million was dispersed based on the population of each of the park agencies. The amounts then for each agency are shown here, and this is the biennial figure, $2.43 million for Anoka County, $430,000 for Bloomington, etc. And this map illustrates where those projects are located. There were 26 projects funded from the fiscal year 2010 appropriation that didn't deal with land acquisition, and this map illustrates where they are. I'll give you more details on those projects later on in the presentation. There were 37 projects from the fiscal year 2011 appropriation, and these two are shown on this map. And at the back of your handout, then, is a spreadsheet that illustrates all of the projects that were funded with the appropriation. First of all, beginning with land acquisitions, and that's found on pages 1 and 2 of the handout. Page 1 illustrates the fiscal year 2010 appropriation. Page 2 illustrates the fiscal year 2011 appropriation. As you'll note, we have $808,000 left to spend of that appropriation for land acquisition projects. That money is available until June 30th of 2013. We use these dollars, as I say, as a match to other funds to help buy land, and it's on a willing seller basis, so we should be able to spend these dollars down before the appropriation expires. Then beginning on page 3 through the end of the spreadsheet, we have the projects that are not dealing with land acquisition. Those that are in yellow are from the fiscal year 2010 appropriation, and those in blue are from the fiscal year 2011 appropriation. The fiscal year 2010 projects, most of them will be completed by June 30th of this year. I should say all but three. And those three that won't are tied to federal grant matches for trail projects. Those have extensions on that appropriation because of that, and those are aligned with the expiration dates of those federal grants. In regards to the fiscal year 2011 appropriation, that appropriation expires on June 30th of 2012 when those projects should be completed. Again, there are 37 of them. All but three will be done by that time. And those three, again, are matching federal transportation grants for trail projects that go beyond that deadline. So there are agencies here. When you see the spreadsheet, there's a contact person for each of the projects if you have additional questions about them at a future time. But I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and if necessary, call those agency staff here if they need to answer your question. So I'd be happy to answer anything you'd like.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Guess you got off lucky.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we have the Minnesota Humanities Center, David O'Fallon. Welcome, Mr. O'Fallon. Would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Thank you, Chairman Erdahl. David O'Fallon. I'm the new guy at the Minnesota Humanities Center. I've been there since November, so I know everything and happy to answer any questions. Actually, I have a handout that's coming around to you, and including a DVD that goes with the handout, and I'll walk us through that briefly. I do not have a PowerPoint, and I do not have as many numbers as you have just been hearing. So,
now, Mr. O'Fallon, where's your hometown?
I am proud to say that hometown was Litchfield, Minnesota, a suburb of Grove City.
Go Dragons.
Go Dragons. I thought of saying that, Chairman Erdahl, but I'm glad you said it first. So, great.
Continue. Great.
Thank you very much. The handout that's coming around to you will describe basically what the Humanities Center has done with the legacy funding. I want to start by introducing the executive directors of the Council of Colors, who are the absolutely exceptional partners. This is a new partnership between the Minnesota Humanities Center and the Council of Black Americans. Lester Collins is here. Lester. The Asian Pacific Island Council, Eileen is here. The Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, Anna Marie is here. And the Chicano Latin Affairs Council, Hector Garcia.
Right behind you.
Hector, back here. Right. This new partnership would not exist without the infusion of the legacy funding. It just would not be happening. So while the humanities are kind of a complex area, I just want to focus on two things that are happening because of this legacy funding. The primary one is the collaboration with these councils on issues that are pertinent to the 700,000 Minnesotans represented by the council, and the rest, you know, all of us, and we live in this state together. So this is an effort to really build some new collaborations and stronger communities to make the state a little stronger and a little better. And as most of you know, the Humanities Center has been focused on education for a long time. Two major issues in education, kind of community public education, the best of our history, core American values, the stories of where we come from and where we're going to, and especially the new challenge that we could not have taken up without the legacy funding, addressing the achievement gap by bringing into education stories that were missing before, information that was missing before, authentic voices developed by leaders and scholars in these communities, and it is having a demonstrated effect on the kids and the teachers as we confront one of our great challenges, which is closing the achievement gap. I won't represent to you that this is the single silver bullet or the answer to everything. It's not. But it is a piece of the puzzle that without this legacy funding, we would not be developing and bringing into professional development for teachers and educators literally across the state. So if you look at the front page of this little handout with me for a moment, I'm just going to highlight a couple of things. For the amount of money that's coming to the Humanities Center, we've created, you've helped us create with these partners, an innovative, we're an entrepreneurial resource for K-12 educators. One of the things I like to say about the Humanities Center is we have a lot of responsibility. We don't have any authority. Nobody needs to work with us. You only work with us if you find something of value. And that makes us innovative and entrepreneurial, and I kind of like that. I'm sort of wired up that way, and I think it makes us responsive to what's really happening. We're creating e-learning opportunities. You got that DVD? That will take you to a website that will connect you with some of the richest resources on the stories of the First Nations in Minnesota, the American Indians in Minnesota. It'll be interactive, and it keeps getting better as information, voices, stories, resources are added to it. So it'll take you right there. It's not a self-contained DVD. We do a lot of community-based education. One of the best things that we do as a Humanities Center is we bring some of the best from the world, like the Smithsonian. We bring scholars and thinkers to Minnesota. We team them up with communities literally from Thief River to Blue Earth, including Dassel, I'm happy to say. In between, my dad owned a gas station in Dassel for a long time. I have a special affinity for Dassel. And we have a kind of general thesis in mind. We think everybody's concerned about the economy and what's happening, how we can grow it. And I won't pretend to you that the Humanities Center is a job engine or the Humanities Center. But the fact is, strong communities create strong education. And strong education creates entrepreneurship and jobs down the road. And I think we can demonstrate that that's true. You see that little flow chart on page 2 inside there? This is the money that we got. Not as big a number as you've heard from some. $2,000,001. And I want to point out to you exactly where that's going. You can see the three major categories for programs and events at the Humanities Center, about 600. For the joint programming with the Councils of Color, they each got 250. And basically a kind of pass-through provision to the Civics Education Coalition. We are the fiscal agent, and we work cooperatively with them, but they pretty much determine their own programming. If you'll focus on that little box with me for a moment that joins the Humanities Center with our partners, you'll see closing the achievement gap and document, and I should say not just document, but present through partnerships with TPT, with community cable networks and so forth, what we're calling the absent narratives of Minnesota, stories that have been left out in many ways or not effectively told in the past. This does have a powerful effect on building stronger communities and on kids and teaching in schools. And we have some research to back this up I'd be happy to get into. And if you see on page 4, collaborative programming, that gives you some examples of the programs. Some of you on this committee, Representative Murphy, you know this is a fairly new partnership. I think you were encouraging of this collaboration among the councils and the Humanities Center. So programming is still being created, discovered. Scholars are still being identified. Leaders in every community are still being approached. Stories are being developed. Programs are being still designed, but we've delivered a lot so far. This gives you some examples of work that is underway. And page 5 gives you in a little more detail. Page 4 points out, I think, how important the collaboration is between the Humanities Center and these councils. As you know, we live in a global society, a global economy. Education is now globally competitive. These councils represent in many ways an increasingly large share of the diversity, the strength, and the future of Minnesota. So collaborating with them, I think, is extremely important to a strong, creative Minnesota. Page 5 gives you some of those examples, which I've talked about a little bit. And then going to pages 6 and 7, this gives you some maps that show the depth and the reach of programs. These are not all legacy-funded programs. They're supported in many ways by some of the legacy funding. Some come from our general operating. But I wanted you to have this picture of the range and the depth and the excellence, quite frankly, of the Minnesota Humanities Center programs across Minnesota. So the map on page 6 and then again the one on page 8 will give you those pictures of programs already presented or programs in the pipeline and in the works being involved. And if you'll just glance with me at the last page for a moment, page 10, we talked a little bit about the impact of our programming, and a number of you have asked in different ways, and I ask myself all the time, as you know, some of you know, I've run a number of different agencies and centers and programs. So you got some money, what did you do with it, to what effect? What is the difference you want to make in the strength of Minnesota? And I want to point again to the one I've mentioned a lot. We are really having an impact on academic achievement. We're building a strong program that will address, it is addressing the achievement gap. Again, no silver bullet, no single thing will fix this very complicated problem. But this is a powerful resource that did not exist before the legacy funding came to us. And these partners with our leaders from these councils of color sitting here gives us an opportunity, I think, to build a network of stronger communities and leaders that without this legacy funding we wouldn't have had before. So that's my overview, Chairman Erdahl, and I'm happy to make more comments or answer any questions if I can.
Thank you, Mr. O'Fallon. Members, do you have any questions? I guess I don't have any either.
Don't you want
no questions?
No questions.
Anything else you want to tell us? You don't have to.
I'm happy, however, just to mention, Chairman and members, that the one or two of the other agencies were asked, well, what would you do if you had more money from the legacy funding? And I think you can see this appropriation is clearly life-changing for the Humanities Center. Enabled us to do things we could not do before, and we would make very good use of increased legacy funding directly to the center. There's no question about that. I think we're working on some of the fundamental challenges the state faces. So,
okay, I do have one question, Mr. O'Fallon.
Yeah.
There's been some talk and consideration of the administrative stipulations in terms of funding that are placed on mm-hmm. on you. Is the 2.5 or 3% for administrative cost is that adequate in your opinion?
Well, I think it's a challenge, to be honest, because you know we're basically a middle-sized organization. We're a 501c3. We're a nonprofit. So when you divide up administration versus absolute direct program delivery, the line gets a little hard. Some more flexibility would be appreciated. As I mentioned in the beginning, I'm kind of wired up to be entrepreneurial, so greater flexibility helps us, I think, actually be more efficient.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Connell, you said that you were new to the position, and I know that your predecessor went off to Georgia. Could you give us a little bit of your background?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, very briefly, Minnesota kid, grew up in Minnesota, went to St. John's, was at the University of Minnesota for a long time, but most recently, just before this position, I was at the McPhail Center for Music. Not being a musician, I thought it was a natural fit, so I went to McPhail Center for Music and frankly helped them grow from 3,400 to over 8,000 students in about 6.5 years. And I don't want to take a lot of your time, but a particular program there that I'm extremely proud of is we went from zero to 960 clients in music therapy in 5.5, 6 years. Before that, I was at the Perpich Center when they built their new building, and we took that program out across the state, I think, in some new substantial ways. I love working with this state, and I would emphasize again how deeply driven I am to have real results, to really make a difference, not just to have a nice program, not just to open an exhibit, but to open it with the intention that people learn something significantly. So whether it's Dassel or Litchfield or War Road, or I bet you know where Manana is, Representative Erdahl.
Yes.
It doesn't come quickly to mind. All right.
I don't know. It does. I do the Manana Parade every year. And
you do not, really.
I just say that Miss Manana is a man.
And the parade's only about a block and a half long.
It is a block and a half. And
right.
I won't talk about Miss Manana.
We don't need to do that. No.
I do have one question, though.
Yes.
You said that you were at the University of Minnesota for a long time?
Yeah.
Is that as a student or an employee?
No, I was there in a position split between the Humphrey Institute. I worked with the Reflective Leadership Program, and I worked with Continuing Education in the Arts, part of their extension programming. And I did a tour of duty in Washington, D.C. at the Kennedy Center. And I was, for a while, the Education Director for the National Endowment for the Arts.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks very much.
I'll just, in brief explanation, you see, in history there is a person known as the Wild Woman of Manana. And this goes back to the 1860s. I'm sure Mr. Kelleher knows all about this. And each June, men run for the title of Miss Manana. It's a very interesting thing. So with that, we are adjourned.